Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Coming up in a few moments. Spotlight Holy Land Coordination with Bishop William Kenny. Highlights of the Pope's Year with John Allen, Senior Correspondent of the National Catholic Reporter. And a glimpse at the Magi in Christian art with art historian Elizabeth Lev. Well, let's begin by speaking about the Holy Land. Each year, a group of bishops from Europe and North America spend a week on pilgrimage in this land in an effort to bring solidarity and support to Christian communities across Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian territories. The visit, organised by the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales at the invitation of the Assembly of Catholic Ordinaries of the Holy Land, is most simply referred to as the Holy Land Coordination. This marks the 13th time the bishops make the pilgrimage, a practice first requested by the Holy See back in 1998. From the 5th to the 10th of January, then, the Holy Land Coordination will be focusing its attention on suffering and vulnerable people. Among the events planned are a visit to a Latin parish in Gaza and another to Syrian and Iraqi refugees in Jordan. There'll also be more official meetings, such as that with the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, His Beatitude Fuad Tual, as well as with the Apostolic Nuncio to Israel, Giuseppe Lazzarotto. I myself will be taking part in this year's pilgrimage and will be sending in interviews and reports over the next few days. Prior to my departure, I spoke to one of the main organisers of this Holy Land Coordination Group. He's the Auxiliary Bishop of Birmingham, William Kenny, who told me what he believes some of the highlights of this year's visit might be in the context of the current political scenario, which, as we know, this past November saw Palestine becoming a non-member observer state of the United Nations. But stay tuned and listen to Bishop Kenny. Bishop Kenny, you're one of the key players in the Holy Land coordination venture. You've been on this January pilgrimage many times before, but this year the visit focuses in a special way on suffering and vulnerable people. What do you believe some of the highlights might be?
I think some of the highlights could be visiting refugees, both in Jordan and in various parts of Palestine. We would also be interested in information about what has happened in the recent war in the Gaza Strip, of course, and how that is affecting the Christian minority. So also we will be looking at the ongoing problems of the occupation and of the situation in which the Christians find themselves.
Each year the backdrop to the visit has a particular context. Would you agree with that? How would you view this year's scenario?
I do agree with that because the context keeps changing. We're now in the context politically, of course, that Israel goes to the polls in the coming weeks. We also have the situation, of course, in Syria, which nobody can be blind to, and also the threats of Israel to go to war with Iran in some way or another. All of that makes one very uneasy indeed. I think particularly the situation in Syria is quite serious because, as was as recently as yesterday being discussed on the more serious news programs, the disintegration of Syria, then, of course, nobody really knows what will happen when a key country like that should, if it goes out of control. So these are the contexts. And again, I suspect very much it will be refugees and the poor who will pay the heaviest price.
Of course, prayer is an important part of this pilgrimage, isn't it?
It is indeed. We will, each day, of course, is rounded in prayer. We celebrate Mass together. We say some office together. We also, usually on the Sunday, try to visit parishes within the Patriarchate and within the other jurisdictions that are there. We also visit some of the other rites as well. Then prayer is most definitely an important part of this.
A year has gone by since you were last there. Do you think the visit last year served a purpose? To what extent?
I think the visit's always always serve a purpose to the extent that they tell the people, our Christian sisters and brothers, the ordinary people, that we're still interested in them, we haven't forgotten them. So I always think they serve a purpose. The events always differ, and trying to organise this is always quite a problem because it really is a moving target, and sometimes even when we are there, the programme is being changed according to the situation that is happening. So it's not always possible to plan and then to carry out that plan. But as I say, the most important thing is that the people see that we come, see that we are interested in their problems, and that then when we return home, we try at least to make our governments and others aware of them.
And while my thanks there go to the Auxiliary Bishop of Birmingham, William Kenny, to whom I'll certainly be speaking to more at length in the course of the visit to the Holy Land, I'd now like to join Susie Hodges as she brings us some of the highlights of Pope Benedict's year. Susie asked John Allen, senior correspondent of the National Catholic Reporter in the United States, to take stock and look back at the past 12 months. Stay tuned.
Well, I suppose being Pope means you never have a dull year, and certainly 2012 was proof of that. You had, on the one hand, a number of sort of internal bits of ferment, fires the Pope had to put out throughout the year, the Vatileaks scandal, the arrest of his own butler, a crackdown on nuns in the United States, and at the same time, there were moments of real accomplishment, an extraordinarily successful trip to Lebanon, a major gathering of the Senate of Bishops to try to light the Church's missionary fires through the new evangelization, culminating, of course, with Benedict XVI becoming in some ways the king of all media with his Twitter debut. So once again in 2012, a mix of lights and shadows, of peaks and valleys.
You mentioned his foreign trip to Lebanon, and the only other one he made last year was to Cuba, Mexico. So definitely a reduction in the number of foreign trips compared to some of his previous years. Presumably this is due to his increasing age. But how successful would you say that both these were put together?
Well, both of these trips, that is the Mexico-Cuba trip and the Lebanon trip, were in a sense symbolically chosen trips, intended to deliver a message not merely to those specific countries, but to the whole regions of the world that they represented. Cuba, of course, a country struggling to come out of its communist isolation and sort of retake its place as a partner in the 21st century. And Lebanon, of course, chosen not merely because Lebanon is the home to the largest Christian community in the Middle East, but also because all across the Middle East, Christians these days are imperiled, and this was an effort by Benedict XVI to express solidarity and support. I would say both of these trips going in were seen to be very challenging outings for the octogenarian Pope, and I think in both cases, on the other side of the trip, the consensus was that they went remarkably well.
As you said, 2012 saw the launch of the Year of the Faith and a Synod of Bishops for New Evangelization. Do you feel they are major events that will help to reinvigorate the Church?
Well, I think, at least in terms of diagnosis, the Pope and the Bishop have their fingers on the right question to be asking. The right question to be asking is, why is it the case that often in comparison with other religious bodies, and in particular with other branches of Christianity, that the Catholic Church sometimes struggles to evangelize? All the data tells us that the Catholic Church actually does a comparatively very good job in terms of retention, that is, holding on to its people from childhood into adulthood. Where the Catholic Church often is outperformed by some of its competitors is in recruitment, that is, in missionary drive. And so by sort of calling for this new evangelization, this idea of relighting the missionary fires of the Church, reaching out in particular to people who perhaps were baptized in the faith but no longer practicing, that certainly is the right project. That certainly would look like the right aim. How much success it's going to have, of course, remains to be seen.
On the technological side, one of the most widely covered events was when Pope Benedict launched his own Twitter account. What does this say, in your view, about the Pope, the Vatican, and its policy towards the new social media and new communications technology in general?
Well, I think quite clearly what the Pope and the Vatican are trying to say is that they want to take the highways and byways of the postmodern world to try to evangelize. That is, they want to try to use all the tools in the evangelical toolbox. And obviously, the Pope going on Twitter is not merely about him personally trying to find another avenue to get his message out, but he's also, I think, trying to set an example for Catholic evangelists and apologists and preachers, you know, all over the world, encouraging them, too, to make use of these new tools of communications technology. Again, I think the effort is undoubtedly on the money. The Church clearly does, has been in a period of being, to some extent, sort of focused on its own internal business and sort of taken its eyes off the prize to a degree of the evangelizing enterprise. Now, how successful Benedict is going to be in stimulating a new springtime of evangelization remains to be seen, but that clearly would be the effort here.
One of the downside aspects of this year was the VatiLeaks scandal with the arrest and trial of the Pope's former butler for stealing and leaking the Pope's confidential documents. How damaging was this affair in your view, and can it now be put behind us?
Oh, I doubt VatiLeaks can be put behind us in the sense that people are going to forget that it happened. I mean, I would suspect that you're going to see screenplays and documentaries and journalistic productions and so forth. And I would also suspect that Paolo Gabrielli, the now pardoned papal butler, is going to be a much sought-after interview subject and so on for some time to come. But I do think that one of the storylines that will emerge with greater clarity is that scandal tends to breed reform, and I think we see some evidence of that in the midst of the VatiLeaks mess as well. Let's not forget that perhaps the most damaging revelations to emerge had to do with Vatican finances. And at the same time, in 2012, we saw Benedict XVI moving the ball in important ways towards greater financial transparency and accountability, in particular inside the Vatican itself. We saw, for example, the Vatican for the first time open itself up to secular European scrutiny of its anti-money laundering protocols as part of the money vault process. We also saw Benedict XVI strengthen the new financial information authority in the Vatican, bringing in a very respected secular professional, René Brulhart from Liechtenstein, to try to head up the financial watchdog agency. And so I do think we see some evidence that as painful and embarrassing as VatiLeaks was throughout the year of 2012, it also created and added to the momentum for a kind of financial glasnost within the Holy See that Benedict XVI has been trying to engineer.
Another major event this year was the publication of Pope Benedict's third book in his Jesus of Nazareth series, a noteworthy accomplishment considering, you know, how busy he is and considering his advanced age. Do you think this book will, and the whole series will, continue to make ripples throughout the world?
Well, I think quite clearly, although Benedict XVI, like any pope, has multiple responsibilities, his real passion is in the teaching dimension of his office. I think in the long run of history, he's going to be remembered as a great teaching pope. And when that story is written, certainly the three volumes that he's given the world on the life of Christ, most recently this year, the short volume on the infancy narrative, will sort of loom large in perceptions of what Benedict XVI was trying to accomplish. I mean, in effect, I think what he's been trying to do is sort of reintroduce the core principles of Christianity to a sort of jaded secular world, convincing people to take a new look, not so much in terms of what Christianity is against, but what it's for. And in this device, trying to lift up and dust off the Jesus stories and get people to take a new look at them, I think is the leading edge of that effort, which is probably the most distinctive element of Benedict's papacy. And we saw it once again in action in 2012.
Okay, let's turn now to the coming year, 2013. What do you see as the highlights and the challenges of this coming year for both the Pope and the Vatican?
Well, it seems that one issue that is coming, that became into crystal clarity during 2012 and will continue to be extraordinarily important for the Church in 2013, is the defense of religious freedom internationally. I think that has quite clearly become the premier social and political concern of the Catholic Church. This is in part because of some church-state wrangles in the West, such as the debate in the States over insurance mandates and so on, but even more so, it's because of the harrowing challenges facing Christianity in a growing number of global hotspots, the Mideast in particular. I think there's great fear in the Holy See that Syria, for example, could be the next Iraq, that is, the next Middle Eastern society in which a once flourishing Christian community is devastated. And I think there is real fear about the future of Christianity across the Middle East, but in many other places as well. In Africa and in some parts of Asia, there's a rising tide of threats of physical violence and persecution and harassment directed at religious minorities generally and Christians in particular. And I think throughout 2013, the Holy See and Benedict XVI are going to try to mobilize the resources of the Church to come to the defense of beleaguered Christians around the world. The success they have in pulling that off, I think, is going to form a great deal of the drama, the Catholic drama of 2013.
And you were listening there to Susie Hodges speaking to John Allen, senior correspondent of the National Catholic Reporter in the United States. My thanks to both of them. Finally, on a more arty note, we join Tracy McClure, who's about to bring us a feature focusing on the Epiphany and Christian art. But I won't give too much away. I'll let Tracy fill you in.
While the Eastern Orthodox are preparing to celebrate Christmas on January 7th, according to the old Julian calendar, Western Christians are getting ready to celebrate the Epiphany on January 6th. It is on this day, the 12th after Christmas on the Gregorian calendar, that the Catholic Church remembers the visit of the three magi, or wise men, who arrived at the stable in Bethlehem to pay homage to the newborn Christ child. In some Catholic dioceses around the world, the Epiphany is celebrated on the Sunday after the first Saturday in January. In Greek, Epiphany means the appearance, miraculous phenomenon. For Christians, like the Star of Bethlehem, it is the shining forth of God's revelation in Jesus Christ. But just how is the Epiphany depicted in Christian art here in Italy, where some of the world's first Christians lived from the time of the Apostle Peter? Well, I talked with Christian art historian Elizabeth Lev, who says the three wise men are among some of the oldest Christian images to be found by archaeologists.
The Feast of the Epiphany is of incredible importance to the history of art, but even more so to the history of humanity. Epiphany means the manifestation. So this, from that first birth of Christ in a stable with an ox, an ass, and a couple of shepherds, we go to the arrival of the outside world that comes to pay homage to Christ. And so in the moment of the Epiphany, we realize that Jesus has come for everybody. It's the great expression of the self-revelation of God on a universal level.
So which exactly were the first Christian images that have come down to us in Christian art?
The earliest Christian images are contained here in Rome. They are catacomb images. Those are the earliest ones that are extant. Although there may be older ones, but we haven't found them yet.
So we've seen the three wise men in some of those catacombs?
The catacombs of St. Priscilla contain 2nd century, at the latest, early 3rd century, images of the three wise men, among other very, very limited number of scenes, but one of them is the three wise men. Most of the other scenes are from the Old Testament. The importance of the Epiphany is such that in some Christological cycles, the image of the Epiphany can take the place of everything. What I mean is, instead of having to show all these different images of the life of Christ, it is enough in a catacomb chapel to put the Epiphany, because all you need to know is God came into the world to show himself to you.
Who were the three kings
who went to Bethlehem?
Well, the three kings undergo tremendous interpretation, reinterpretation, and reinterpretation during the course of the centuries. As a matter of fact, they are magi, which is interpreted by us today as wise men in the Middle Ages, the idea of kingship, and so we call them the three kings. But the word magi is the word magician. These are men who are capable of great prodigies. These are men who are already very wise. They have a connection to things that are not easily accessible to people of this world. So they're seen as something that already have a contact and understanding with the invisible and, by extension, the divine. And that these three men, who are all pagan, recognize that there is this divine moment in act, the divine is coming into the world, and they travel from far, far, far away to bring homage to that divinity, shows this recognition of the foreign, the external of the coming of Christ.
There are stories that tell us there was Melchior, Gaspar, and Baldassare coming from Europe, Asia, and Africa.
That is a later vision of the names are given to the Magi in the Middle Ages. The placement is given to the Magi almost immediately. The image of Priscilla, the image of the catacombs of Priscilla, shows the Magi, at least as we can distinguish today, we can't tell their faces apart. We can't really tell the gifts apart. The only thing we see is that one is green, one is white, and one is red. And so at this point, we see them as representing geographic space. They wear these funny hats that are indicative of foreigners. For an ancient Roman, they would recognize the hat as someone who was not Roman. It was a freedman's hat. And so here you have these three different colors, three different continents, three different parts of the known world that are not Rome, coming to pay homage to this king, to this child, to God. Later on in the Magi cycle, the Magi will also represent, and to me this is one of the more interesting aspects, the sense of magician. They represent three different philosophical systems that the Christianity, the self-revelation of God, that puts to rest or supersedes, if you will. And so one of the wise men would be represented as the Eastern tradition of Zoroaster, and this sort of very complex, exotic religions of the East and these philosophical systems that render their homage, that Christ supersedes them. The second thinking system, of course, would be the great Greek system, the descended from Plato, the Hellenistic tradition of thought. And again, they bear gifts and they render homage to the truth that is greater than theirs. And then finally, the last of the Magi would be Daniel, and would represent the Old Testament, recognizing the arrival of the fulfillment of the scriptures in Jesus. The Magi are everywhere. They are everywhere. In the early years, you'll see them transform from a hastily painted fresco on a catacomb wall to the carved sarcophagi. If you were to ever go to some place like the Pio Christian Museum of the Vatican Museums, you would see walls, entire walls, representing the scene of the Epiphany, because it was so important to the 4th century, 5th century people who insisted on having this image on their coffins. Then one of the most colorful, one of the most fun, interesting images of the Magi is in Santa Maria Maggiore, and you have to look a little carefully. It's on the triumphal arch above the altar, and you will see on the left and on the right, you will see the Magi. But they're not wearing the simple tunics that they've worn in the 3rd and 4th century images. They wear these crazy, multicolored, exotic costumes that look like they have sequins on them, to show, again, that idea of the exotic magicians, these people from a faraway land, from different systems, these kings, this royalty, who once again bear homage to Christ. Then walk into any art museum in the world and you'll start to see the Magi represented in by the best painters that Italy produced, that France produced. You can see the Magi by Roger van der Weyden, by Hugo van der Goes. You can see the Magi by Gentile da Fabriano, by Mantegna. There are so many images because this is a story that never, ever tires. And now, as of 2006, you can go to the movie theater, so you can go to your DVD rental store, and you can see the Three Magi reinterpreted one more time in the movie The Nativity, where the Magi play a huge role, but they play the role of science here. They play the role of science recognizing the greatness of Jesus.
In what way?
Well, The Three Magi in the film are represented as a group of men who are surrounded by their instruments and their charts and their books and all the things that give proofs and indications. But when they realize that something extraordinary is happening, they have to get over their reluctance to leave the safety of their laboratory, to leave things in a theoretical, just understanding state, and to go out and to physically experience the arrival of this divine manifestation. And they have no doubt when they arrive, and the last thing they would expect, they arrive before a stable and they're clearing away the sheep. There is a humble man and a humble woman and a child lying in a manger, and they don't hesitate, they don't look at each other with bewilderment, they bring their gifts to this child because they see the divine.
You're talking about this movie. We've talked about other images of the three wise men in art and architecture. But it sounds to me that it's their role or who they were was very much open to interpretation or to fantasy in a way. I mean, do we have in the scriptures very many indications as to who they were and where they came from?
No, that's why the scriptures give us a very bare-bones account of these three magi, these three wise men who came from afar and who brought gifts. And from there, the three men, the gifts, the gifts are a fulfillment of scriptural writing of Isaiah, but the
gold,
frankincense and myrrh. The wise men, their provenance, their day jobs, they have been interpreted and reinterpreted, and that is the essence of the story, because the point of the story is the universality of Christ. And so if we could fit those three men into cages and say that these are the people that Jesus came for, then it would miss the point of being that Jesus came for everyone. So you will see images of the three wise men as old, middle-aged, and young. You'll see the three wise men as black, white, and Asian. They will be everything to everybody because the point is that Jesus came for everyone.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
And you were listening there to Tracy McClure speaking to art historian Elizabeth Lev. Many thanks to them. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join me then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on English World. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.